love from way down in New Orleans. And from a youngster on, everybody's always treated me swell and enjoyed my music. I'm just so satisfied over everything.
I was born long, long ago, July the 4th, 1900. Back of town, down in James Alley, just a boy from New Orleans.
When I was home. Why is the 20th century the American century in music? It's primarily because of Louis Armstrong. That's the force.
Sometimes these people come along in any field, whether it's science or medicine or the arts, who just revolutionize things, and we can't quite explain how they do that, except that they have some gift of imagination which explores the outer boundaries of what is at the given time being done, and they say, hey, wait a minute, that's not enough. I can go much further. I can go much deeper.
I really do think of him as the American Bach. I think that he operates at that level. And you listen to some of those inventions, and it just makes your skin shiver.
Satchmo, Mr. Jazz, Pops, Ambassador Satch, Louis Armstrong. Had he lived, Louis Armstrong would have celebrated his 100th birthday on July 4th, 2000. Armstrong's self-proclaimed date of birth. He was actually born on August 4th, 1901. It is hard to overstate the incredible reach of this original American artist. He defined American culture, and he did it with the force of his talent. As a musician, singer, composer, author, innovator, entertainer, actor, and bandleader, he transcended racial barriers, and he became America's ambassador to the world. The genesis of Armstrong's genius is elusive.
We can't really understand or begin to explain Armstrong any more than we can really understand Mozart. There are just certain things that are just beyond us. We don't know really what genius is made of or how it's formed.
I can't give you anything but love, baby.
As a singer, Armstrong influenced everyone.
He didn't learn to sing in Milan. He got his voice training with a New Orleans newsboy quartet. It used to chirp on the curbstone for pennies.
If you heard him sing, you would never say, oh, was that Louis Armstrong or somebody else?
No, no, they can't take that away from me. No, they can't take that away.
People may not be charmed by what they hear in his voice, but most people will accept Frank Sinatra, Bing Crosby, Billie Holiday, Chuck Berry, or Louis Jordan.
Armstrong's trumpet set the standard for all trumpet players.
It is the University of Louis Armstrong that America went to, no matter what instrument you played, whether you were Errol Garner or Teddy Wilson. This is a university that you went to forever. No diploma, because you never graduated. You were never going to know enough about it. Doesn't matter whether you were Lester Young, Lady Day, or who you were. That's the university that you came from.
I was afraid of it. He had everybody hypnotized, but they never heard a trumpet player like that before.
He didn't learn to play the trumpet in a conservatory. He practiced on a battered old bugle in the New Orleans Waves Home for Boys. His professors were the sons of Old Man River, the musicians who worked on the Mississippi River boats.
He must have practiced a great deal to become so secure in doing these things, which really no other trumpet player even thought of doing, let alone was able to do.
Louis Armstrong is the man who put the swing into jazz.
Where does swing come from? You can list a lot of places it comes from, but if you have to do it in two words, Louis Armstrong.
S-W-I-N-G. Pops was a master at swinging. If we could take the Webster's Dictionary and open it up to see what S-W-I-N-G means, you would see a picture of Louis Armstrong there.
Louis Armstrong walked with royalty.
He was born back of town with every possible obstacle before him. And yet his genius took him across the world to triumphs in concert halls, command performances before kings and presidents, audiences with popes.
The pope asked him, was he married? And so he told him, yeah, daddy. He said, I've been married 5 times. He told him, you got any children? He said, no, daddy, but I'm working at it every night.
Now you blow through here, the music go down the round, oh, the whole, and it comes up here.
He also walked with the common man.
He would just soon not stand on that receiving line. Every time Louis shook a hand, he wanted to go off with the person, you know. He liked to get to know the people. In all of the years, and with all of the success that Louis has had, Louis still remained the man in the street himself.
Louis Armstrong was a hitmaker, too. He even unseated the Beatles from the top of the charts with Hello, Dolly.
Hello, Dolly. This is Louis, Dolly. It's so nice to have you back where you belong.
For Louis Armstrong, it was a wonderful world.
I see trees of green.
And those who came in contact with him were changed forever. I'm Nancy Wilson, inviting you to join Stanley Crouch for this special edition of NPR's Jazz Profiles, Satchmo, The Wonderful World of Louis Armstrong.
What a wonderful world.
This hour, Louis Armstrong, the man and his music, part one.
Folks, if you're ready to join me, I'd like to take you back to some of the places where my kind of music really began. We are starting down in my hometown, New Orleans. My man in those days was old Papa Joe Oliver. He was my friend and my teacher and my inspiration and a great creator. We're going to start out with a number that goes back to the King Oliver Band. And I was playing second cornet for Papa Joe when we made the first version of this one in 1923. We call this the Dipper Mouth Blues, one of my old nicknames. Some folks call it the Sugarfoot Stomp. No matter which way you call it, it still brings back a lot of memories.
In 1923, playing the Dipper Mouth Blues with Joe Oliver, Louis Armstrong was already over a decade into his career as a musician. In Chicago's nightclubs and recording studios, it must have seemed like a completely different world from his birthplace, New Orleans. He was playing, he was recording, his star was ascending, things were moving for Louis. But then, from his earliest days, he was always on the run. He had to be, growing up in New Orleans.
By the time Louis Armstrong arrived in New Orleans, sometime around the turn of the century, it was a city that was beginning to shed a colonial heritage that was very different from the rest of the United States.
Bruce Rayburn is the director of the Hogan Archives at Tulane University in New Orleans.
It had been French and Spanish and African, and even though the Americans took it over in 1803, it took them a century to Americanize the city. By the time Armstrong comes into the picture, that's happening, and jazz is emerging as an aspect of that Americanization. Music was part of the daily existence of the people of New Orleans. It wasn't a luxury like it was in many cities. It was a necessity, like water and bread and rice. Necessities carry low prices because everyone needs them, so it was hard for musicians to make a lot of money. But what you got was your soul. Music was a way of exploring your personality and sharing it with other people.
How did Louis Armstrong blossom? It was not due to any type of privileged childhood. Lawrence Berggren, author of Louis Armstrong, An Extravagant Life.
Of course, Armstrong coming in as the descendant of ex-slaves was really at the bottom of a very structured case system. He was, in a way, in a very, very difficult position. His prospects in life were very poor. However, there was another side to what was a very bleak picture. He always said that he had the most wonderful childhood anybody could imagine. And if you're aware of the poverty, the degradation, the illness, and just the general difficulties he and his family faced every day, you wonder what in the world he's talking about, because it made a, quote, Dickensian childhood seem mild by comparison.
I remember the time in New Orleans when I was a little youngster, you know, after I'd left James Alley, back of town, they call it New Orleans, you know. They had the good old street parades, you know, and brass bands, and every one of them was great. They'd all congregate in front of the Eagle Saloon at Ramfort Medita, and there was one brass band there that I'd always follow. Okay, how many bands on the street? There was the Onward Band with Joe Oliver and Manuel Perez in that band. Big old Eddie Jackson on that bass, you know, blowing that four beats. Cats would play a tune like Panama, the guys that follow the parade. They would applaud, and old Joe Oliver played encore. I was just a kid digging all this.
Louis soaked up the sounds of New Orleans. It was his first musical education. I'm Stanley Crouch. It's Louis Armstrong, the man and his music, on this special edition of NPR's Jazz Profiles. Louis was surrounded by women as a child. His father was not a factor. He credits his mother for passing on the good common sense that would help him in his life. For Louis, good common sense meant making music. It was a natural solution for him. Dan Morgenstern is the director of jazz studies at Rutgers University.
He was in constant need of money. Of course, things were very bad at home, and he wanted to contribute. So he organized this quartet in which he sang tenor.
The boys was harmonizing, and I was just singing pretty notes with their harmony.
They sang in the street and apparently were very good at it. Louis said that they sometimes did very well in terms of what they might bring home. They sang popular songs of the day, and they probably did a little bit of dancing too and entertaining. And this is really where he starts his career as a performer.
Drummer Zooty Singleton remembers Louis's quartet, the Singing Fools.
They used to sing with a quartet. They used to sing like mad, man. They had a quartet that used to harmonize back. I used to see Louis all the time. He was in short trousers then. That's before he went to the bad boys home.
Life on the street had its pitfalls, as Louis was soon to discover. Author Lawrence Berggren.
He was nobody's idea of a juvenile delinquent or troublemaker until that night, New Year's Eve 1912, when he fired off a pistol at New Year's to commemorate the moment. And of course, he was much too young to be doing this, and he was arrested by two detectives on the spot. To his horror and to his dismay, he was immediately sentenced to what was then called the Colored Waves Home, which was on the outskirts of New Orleans and in the middle of a swampy area. It was a reform school.
The Waves Home was very important to Louis Armstrong's development, because that was where he first received formal instruction in music.
All the way back in 1913, I was in the orphanage as a bugle boy, and cornet player went home, they gave me the cornet, and we used to march the boys to church. The saints go marching in.
Oh, when the saints, go marching in, Now when the saints go marching in, yes, I want to be in that number when the saints go marching in.
Go ahead, Brother Holmes.
When the saints go marching in, yes, I want to be in that number when the saints go marching in.
The Waits Home was not, however, where Lewis first played the horn. That happened before Reform School, when Lewis worked for the Karnofskys, a Russian Jewish family who ran a junk business. Author Dan Morgenstern.
Lewis shared chores with some of the Karnofsky offspring, riding on a wagon. They would collect coal that had been dropped from the railroad at the station and resell that to the prostitutes in Storyville, and they would collect junk. He would blow on a tin horn sitting on this wagon. That's how he started actually blowing a horn. But then, he says, the Karnofskys gave him $5 to buy a horn in a pawn shop that he had seen, a cornet, which he said was very dirty, but he cleaned it up and made it look real good. And that's when he really started to play the trumpet.
Lewis heard Russian Jewish melodies at the Karnofsky home. And in the street, he heard the black and Creole brass bands, church music. And when Lewis bought his first phonograph in 1918, he began listening to the great Irish tenor, John McCormick, and to the great Italian tenor, Enrico Caruso. Coming out of the Waits Home in 1913, Lewis went back to the streets and came under the influence of trumpeter Joe King Oliver. The King would soon be his most important mentor. There were other trumpet players who undoubtedly had an influence on the young Lewis Armstrong. Author Dan Morgenstern.
But it was Joe Oliver who took the time to look after this talented young man, give him pointers, show him how to do things on the trumpet, also gave him little jobs running errands for his wife and so on. I mean, he almost took young Louis under his wing and was probably the closest thing to a father figure in Armstrong's life. So he had an enormous influence, not only musically, but also personally.
He did a lot for all the youngsters, to Red Allen, Lou Russell, myself, and a whole lot of New Orleans kids. Joe Oliver will always be the boss.
Stella Oliver, the widow of Joe Oliver, remembers Armstrong as a young boy.
He was very young. He used to run errands for us. He'd come to my house with nothing but a boy, and he followed Joe every step Joe went around. And Joe was fond of him. He was fond of Joe. And I used to always call him my boy.
Lewis worshipped the ground Joe Oliver stood on, so it was painful for him when Oliver left New Orleans for Chicago. Joe made sure that Lewis got his job, however, with the best band in town, the Kid Ory Band. Lewis was also asked to work as a musician on the Streckfuss Riverboat Line. It was here that he learned to read music and sharpen his playing. Educator, composer, and music historian, Guther Schuller.
Armstrong actually learned more about reading music when he worked on those boats because they played kind of written arrangements and things, so he had to learn.
In In the era before radio and even before recorded jazz, the Fate Marable Riverboat Band was the cream of the crop. For many of their patrons on the boat and in the towns that dotted the Mississippi River, this was their first exposure to jazz. The riverboats brought the music north to Memphis, to St. Louis, and as far north as Davenport, Iowa. Lewis had his first opportunity to see what life was like outside of New Orleans. Author Lawrence Burgreen.
And he was, at that point, having some very difficult entanglements with his first wife, Daisy, who was a prostitute. He had met her in a honky-tonk, and she was also a very violent person. He was, in his own way, as unfaithful as she was, and she was also very jealous. So he was glad to get out of town, to get away from her.
Eventually, Lewis would leave New Orleans for good. On August 8, 1922, Lewis Armstrong received a telegram from King Oliver asking him to join his band in Chicago. Scholar Dan Morgenstern.
When King Oliver sent a telegram in 1922, Louis was ready to leave New Orleans. He had already made explorations on the riverboats and spent some time in St. Louis and so on. It's not as if he was a total hick, you know, when he left New Orleans.
King Oliver sent for me to come and play second trumpet with him. That's all she wrote. I thought so much of him, could nobody hold me. I would never leave home until he sent for me.
At age 21, carrying, of course, his horn and a trout sandwich made by his mother, Lewis headed north by train to the unknown future in Chicago. But at least he would be there with Joe Oliver, whom he trusted absolutely. We'll take that trip and much more as we continue our look at Lewis Armstrong, The Man and His Music, Part 1. By 1922, Lewis was on his way to Chicago.
It was a little daunting for him to get on that train by himself and go all the way up to Chicago, which then was the largest African-American settlement anywhere in the United States.
Dan Morgenstern is the director of the Institute of Jazz Studies at Rutgers University.
He knew that he was ready, and I think he knew that he had to leave his hometown because if he had stayed there, it was by the early 20s, a bit of a musical backwater. The great musicians had almost all left. Sidney Bechet was gone, Jimmy Noon was gone, the Dodge Brothers were gone, Oliver was gone, Kid Ory was gone. They were all up north. So it was time for him to make that move.
Chicago was the Silicon Valley of the 1920s. With an influx of inexpensive labor, Chicago was experiencing a great boom. There was plenty of money around, and since these were the days of prohibition, people looked to nightclubs for entertainment. That was where the booze was, the girls were, and so was the music. Lawrence Burgreen is the author of Lewis Armstrong, An Extravagant Life.
Jazz was just one aspect of its phenomenal growth. This was the height of the Prohibition era, and Chicago was a city controlled by gangs and syndicates like Al Capone. This lawlessness or anarchy was the perfect environment for jazz to grow and flourish. This is where the record companies and radio manufacturers were taking root. So it was a very attractive place to be, and when Armstrong received his telegram from Joe Oliver saying, you know, get on a train, come north, Armstrong was only too glad to do it.
Well, I get to Chicago, and King Oliver had been waiting for that train, but he had to go to work, and my train was late. But he left word with the porters to put me in a cab. I'd have gone back home. First time looking at all them tall buildings up north. And finally, I went to the Lincoln Garden and heard that music. And I still didn't think I should go in. The band was so good, and they were swinging. So finally somebody told Joe, and he came out and said, you better come on in, yeah. And I went to work the next night.
Dan Morgenstern, director of the Institute of Jazz Studies.
And Armstrong's experience in the Oliver Band was very, very important. It gave him confidence in his own abilities. He soon realized that people were coming to hear him and Oliver together. Oliver was already very well established. He had a famous band, but it was when Armstrong joined that all these musicians really began to flock to the Lincoln Gardens to hear this extraordinary cornet team.
Stella Oliver, widow of King Oliver.
Well, they had quite a nice band up there. All the downtown big folks used to come to the garden to hear Joe play. Him and Louis were playing together, and they used to make what they called then breaks. When Louis would make a break, Joe would catch it just like that.
It was his solo on Chimes Blues that got things started for Louis in Chicago.
Yep, that's my first trumpet solo up north from New Orleans, because I had just joined Joe Oliver's second trumpet man. That was Joe Oliver and myself, Honoré Dutré on trombone, Baby Dots on drums, and Johnny Dots clarinet, and Lil Hardin on the piano, and Bill Johnson on bass.
Armstrong also wanted to sing. It was part of him from the early days with the Singing Fools back home in New Orleans. But there would be no singing for Louis in the King Oliver Band. That would come later with the creation of his own band. It was in the Oliver Band that Louis would meet the pianist, Lil Hardin, whom he would eventually marry. She was a trained musician. She had been to Fisk University and was a child prodigy. They came from completely different backgrounds. Lil recalls that she was quite reluctant to spend any time with somebody as rough around the edges as the young Louis Armstrong.
I said, you don't look right. I said, you've got to change your clothes. So he said, what's the matter with my clothes? I bought this from a guy. Everything he had on was secondhand.
Although Louis didn't appear to be suave and sophisticated, one note from his horn made people pay attention. In fact, his musicianship was felt throughout the Oliver Band, and soon, with Louis playing second trumpet, there would be a threat to King Oliver. He wasn't trying to outshine anybody, he was just playing. But the quality of that kind of solo led to problems for Joe Oliver.
We got the record date to make the Jeanette record. At the first session, Louis was there, right, as he always was next to Joe. Didn't work out. Couldn't hear a note Joe was playing.
My tone was stronger than his. See, I would never play over Joe. That's the respect I had for him. But if he'd have thought of it, he'd let me play the lead. You notice all these records you hear, more harmony. Jinka, 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 because his lead was weak. That's why I had to get back to the door to play the second.
They moved Louis way over in the corner, away from the band. Louis was standing over there looking so lonesome, he thought it was bad for him to have to be away from the band, you know? I'd look at him and smile, you know? And that's the only way they could get the bounce. Louis was, well, he was at least 12 or 15 feet from us.
Oliver was smart enough to know that Louis was soon going to outplay him if he wasn't already doing so. Lil Armstrong.
I probably would have never paid any attention to Louis' playing if King Oliver hadn't said to me one night that Louis could play better than he could. He says, but as long as I keep him with me, he won't be able to get ahead of me. I'll still be the king.
Lil started thinking.
I said to Louis, well, now look, we married. Now I said, I don't want you playing second trumpet. You got to play first. So he says, play first? Where am I going to play first? I said, well, then you'll have to quit Joe and find your job playing first. One thing or the other. I said, you can't be married to Joe and married to me, too. So he said, well, what do you want me to do? I said, I want you to give him a notice. So he gave Joe his notice.
Louis had received his marching orders. Fletcher Henderson had heard Louis in New Orleans. He had been wanting Louis to join his band for a while. It was one of the most successful bands. That band featured the arrangements of saxophonist and composer Don Redman. It also featured a young tenor saxophone star named Coleman Hawkins. Louis packed up and hit the road for New York City.
I noticed a whole lot of things when I went to New York from Chicago to join Fletcher Henderson's band. They had big arrangements and everybody was playing their parts. And you notice the weakest man in that band was the first chairman. And I always say, if a band don't have a good first chairman on the trumpet and on the sax, he don't have no band. Because you don't hear nothing but harmony and things like that, and you lose it.
But Lil Hardin still wasn't content.
I noticed in Fletcher's billing, there's nothing but Fletcher Henderson's orchestra. Nobody else's name. So I said, well, you're situated all right. I'm going on back to Chicago. So I went back home.
Lil came back to Chicago and approached the management at the Dreamland nightclub. She convinced them to hire her band featuring Louis, but with a huge banner outside proclaiming Louis Armstrong, the world's greatest trumpet player.
So I wrote, told Louis, I said, well, you give Fletcher your 2 weeks' notice and come on back home. I said, because I've got a job for you for $75 a week. And Louis didn't believe me, you know, and he didn't want to leave. He kind of liked playing with Fletcher. He said he wasn't coming back. So I said, well, I've already got the job, and if you're not here by this date, then don't come at all.
But Louis was busy in New York. By the spring of 1925, he was providing background for some of the best female blues singers of the 1920s, including Ma Rainey, Clara Smith, and the Empress of the Blues, Bessie Smith. Musician, composer, conductor, and historian, Gunther Schuller.
When blues came in so strong in the early 20s in the recording industry and really kind of fed the so-called race record part of the industry, blues sort of took over the music and took it away from ragtime. I think Bessie Smith taught Louis Armstrong more about the blues than the other way around. He learned a lot about inflection, about how to glide into a note, how to scoop it, how to inflect it in a personal way. This is something that had to be learned to do on the trumpet. And I think he got a lot of that from Bessie Smith, and that became part of his repertory and then almost all trumpet players that have ever played since.
When he backed the singers, the sound of his trumpet soared.
Edward Fletcher told my wife at that time, Lil, in Chicago, she had a band at the Dreamland. She said, you better come on and join my band. And she put her foot down and said, you come now, don't come at all.
Once back in Chicago, Louis got busy. He played, and he played, and he played. He played in Lil's band, and he also performed with the band of Erskine Tate at the Vendome Theater. Tate was the man who asked Louis to switch to the trumpet, and it would be in his band that Louis would play the trumpet for the first time.
he asked me to change from the cornet to the trumpet, so I changed and I liked it better. I think it was a more mellow tone, you see.
I'm Stanley Crouch. It's Louis Armstrong, the man and his music, on this special edition of NPR's Jazz Profiles. In 1925, he assembled the Louis Armstrong Hot Five, his first band. It featured Kid Ory on trombone, Johnny Dodds on clarinet, Johnny St. Cyr on banjo, Lil Hardin on piano, and of course, Louis himself on trumpet. The Hot Five was assembled for recording purposes only and never ever performed live. Having his own recording band liberated Louis to decide his own musical destiny. And these records feature Louis talking, singing, and emerging as an entertainer. During the period of the Hot Five, and later in the expanded Hot Seven, Louis extended the possibilities for the instrumentalist in jazz. Largely due to his talent and his inspiration, the jazz solo was beginning to emerge, and Louis Armstrong was the man making it happen. With his improvisations, he extended the range of the trumpet, and he firmly established himself as the premier innovator in jazz. Spurred on by his reception, Louis's physical stamina and musical creativity made the late 1920s one of the most important periods in his entire career and in the entire history of jazz as well. The Earl Hines biographer, jazz critic Stanley Dance.
The most significant period perhaps was the Hot Five and the period when he was with Earl Hines. In my view, two of the greatest musicians in jazz who complemented one another beautifully.
We met in the Musicians Union. I had come to Chicago with a little trio.
Earl Father Hines was a pianist from Pittsburgh who, like Louis Armstrong, migrated to Chicago in search of opportunity. He and Armstrong would work together several times during their long careers. They met in Chicago, and it wasn't long before they knew they were on to something very, very special.
This Gatsby guy comes over to me and says, "Man, you ain't from around here, are you?" I said, "No." He said, "You New Orleans?" I said, "No." He said, "I didn't think you was, the way you were talking." He said, "What, you fooling around with the piano out there in the roadhouse the other night?" I said, "Yeah." I said, "What are you?" I said, "You a musician?" He said, "Yeah, I play a little trumpet." I said, "Well, we ought to get together sometime, you know." So he said, "Well, that's all right with me." He says, "I got my mouthpiece now, anybody got a horn," just like that. And he said, "We got to get together." And that's how we formed our relationship, and we had been personal friends ever since.
By 1928, Hines replaced Lil as pianist in a new edition of the Armstrong Band, and they recorded an enduring masterpiece. Louis Armstrong's opening cadenza to the King Oliver composition, West End Blues, is universally considered one of the landmarks in the history of jazz. By using rhythmic and harmonic invention on virtuosic and sophisticated levels that had no precedent, Louis redefined what was possible for a jazz artist. Music critic Leonard Feather recalls his reaction to West End Blues.
It was so warm and so beautiful. It was unlike any of the conventional dance music that you could hear around London, you know, that perfectly formed opening cadenza, Louis' beautiful wordless vocal and Earl Hines' piano solo, all the way up to Louis' high C in that last chorus and Zooty Singleton's little click-off ending. That West End Blues is a very, very moving experience.
Earl Hines was surprised when the record came out on the market. He brought it by my house. We'd forgot we had recorded it. And Joe Alva wrote this tune, and we didn't have nothing but one page of the blues he had on there. This introduction, we had to make one, and that's what it was. That introduction I put on West End Blues. Thank you. as your West End blues.
Recorded by Louis Armstrong in 1928. It is considered to this day one of the most important recordings in jazz history. After those final sessions in Chicago, Louis moved back to New York and began to record popular songs. Then the crossover hits began. Louis came into his own as a singer.
There's a tune here called I Can't Give Anything But Love. It was recorded in 1929. J.C. Hickenbottom was on the trombone at that time, and he was in his prime, too. It was recorded while the time I was a guest with Lou Russell's band at Savoy.
I can't give you anything but love. Baby, that's the only thing I'm plenty of. Baby, dream my wild, scheme my wild, babe. You should do mine. Mine, love, I love, I love all happiness. And I grant all the things that you have probably do. Gee, I'd like to see you looking swell for baby. Bad light little diamond bracelet. Woodward tops on sale. My little baby don't want home. Tell that lucky day. Your lucky day, you know darn well. Baby, baby, I can't give you anything but love.
In the summer of 1929, Louis made his Broadway debut in Hot Chocolates and began a long and personal relationship with composer, pianist, Fats Waller, who wrote the score for the show. Ain't Misbehavin' was the big hit. Fresh off his success on Broadway, Louis hit the road again, something he was to do for the rest of his life. This time, the destination was California. The year was 1930, and Louis met actor and singer Bing Crosby. Bing would fall under the Armstrong spell, and it would not be long before Louis Armstrong, the musician, would become Louis Armstrong, the actor.
I saw where Louis was going to be playing at Frank Sebastian's Cotton Club in Culver City. We were there every night, and I got to know Louis personally and always visited wherever he was playing after that, in Culver City or Los Angeles.
Out on the West Coast, Louis's reputation as the world's greatest trumpet player had preceded him, and all the trumpet players turned out to see him at the top of his game. Trumpeter Teddy Buckner was one of the crowd.
When Louis first came out to California, that's when Louis was in his prime. No trumpet player in the world could take him. And we used to rush to get through our last show so I could catch Louis on the radio. And that's when he was featuring Shine. That's when he used to hit all those high C's.
With tunes like Shine, Louis continued to explore the outer reaches of the trumpet.
Thank you.
In 1931, Armstrong opened up at the Showboat in Chicago with a new band, and this meant having to cope once again with the gangsters who controlled the nightclub business, trombonist Preston Jackson.
We opened up at the Showboat. That's the place where Louis had a lot of trouble with gangsters. One night, two gangs was in there. One fella made a pass at the other one girl, and he didn't like it, and so he hit him in the head with a ginger ale bottle. But I never saw so many guns in my life. Louis just stood up there playing.
Not always attentive to details, Louis was conned into signing conflicting contracts, and gangsters were fighting over him. Armstrong biographer Gary Giddens.
There were these mob wars over entertainers in Chicago. Guys were actually taken for rides and never returned. Somebody walked over to Armstrong, as Armstrong told the story in the club where he was playing, and said, "There's a telephone for you." And the guy took out a gun and marched him over to the phone. The guy on the phone said, "Are you going to be on that train tomorrow morning?" And he said, "Yes." And again, an act of courage and self-possession, he wasn't. He skipped town that night, and he was on the run.
After his first trip to Europe in 1932, Louis Armstrong returned stateside with a new recording contract at RCA Victor. With a new band, he hit the road. And in the summer of 1933, Louis returned to Europe and eventually moved to Paris for the longest vacation of his career. Back home, there were rumors that gangsters were after him and that he had problems with his lip. Louis wanted to come back home, but after several years abroad, the question was, what was he coming back home to? Louis Armstrong had already become a legend as one of the preeminent black entertainers in the new world of records, radio, nightclubs, talking pictures, and the Broadway stage. But all of this was now in question. Could he revive his career and save his professional life? I'm Stanley Crouch. I'll see you next time for the conclusion of Louis Armstrong, the man and his music.
The executive producer for Jazz Profiles is Tim Owens, assistant producer Madeline Smith. Louis Armstrong, the man and his music, was written and produced by Dan Morgenstern, Jim Luce, and Dick Golden. Technical director, Duke Marcos. We'd also like to thank the Institute of Jazz Studies at Rutgers University in Newark, the Hogan Archives at Tulane University in New Orleans, Gary Giddens, Phoebe Jacobs, Bruce Rayburn, Jack Bradley, the BBC, and WBGO Newark. The executive producer of Satchmo, The Wonderful World of Louis Armstrong, is Jim Luce. Major support for this special edition of Jazz Profiles comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the National Endowment for the Arts, and the Wallace Reader's Digest Funds, seeking to enrich community life through support of education, arts, and culture. Additional support has been provided by Auris Swiss Watches since 1904 on the web at www.auris.ch and by Carry Audio Design, makers of high-end audio equipment for the home, on the web at www.carryaudio.com. To email us or for more information about this program and others in our series, contact us through NPR's homepage on the World Wide Web at npr.org. That's npr.org. The Wonderful World of Louis Armstrong is produced by the Luce Group and National Public Radio in association with WRTI-FM Philadelphia as part of the Louis Armstrong Centennial Radio Project. I'm Nancy Wilson. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Thanks for listening. To hear more programs in this series, go to npr.org/jazzprofiles.